This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Paul Gottfried. We're going to be discussing his new book called Fascism, the Career of a Concept. Paul Gottfried, it is great talking to you again.
Well, thank you for having me on.
And I'm also joined with my new co-host, Alex von Goldstein. Alex,
it's a pleasure.
Great having you on. I guess, Alex, since you haven't been on the show, if you want to give like a brief introduction.
Oh, sure. I am Alex von Goldstein. I'm a millennial. I'm 26 years old, and I live in North New Jersey. And over the last year, I've found myself somewhere between the dissident right and radical center. So that's me.
Yeah, that sounds pretty similar to where I'm coming from. So, Paul, your book out is called Fascism, the Career of a Concept. And with fascism, it's one of those like buzzwords in politics and culture. If someone dislikes something, they automatically refer to it as fascism. On the left, anyone who is politically incorrect is automatically a fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have conservatives will go on and they'll talk about, they'll use these buzzwords like there's Islamofascism, there's ecofascism, there's the famous Jonah Goldberg book, Liberal Fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And none of these people are actually able to come up with a coherent definition of what fascism basically is. So in your book, you sort of trace the origins of that. So in your book, you start out talking about how fascism came to power. But what really got you to write this book?
What got me to write, or two things that got me to write the book. Number one, I was profoundly impressed by a book on fascism written by the German historian Ernst Nolte, which I read in German about 45 years ago, and it was called Der Faschismus und seine Epoche, which I think is translated Three Faces of Fascism. And I thought it was one of the most fascinating books I ever read. I never believed that, you know, Hitler was a generic fascist. I always knew fascism, Nazism, was a synthetic ideology which drew heavily from Stalinism as well as other movements of the interwar period, and was ultimately determined by Hitler's genius and lunacy. But the fascists interested me, and they were mostly a Latin movement that came out of a Latin Catholic culture, which seemed to be looking back to Roman antiquity, but at the same time spoke about national revolution. And I was fascinated by Nolte's treatment of this. I also read a book by someone who has since then become a close friend of mine, Stanley Payne, who's probably the world's expert on fascism and seems to consider me now the expert on fascism. But Stanley did some excellent books on, you know, how to define what are the features of generic fascism. And I sort of returned to this after I heard the word fascism used ad infinitum as a term by which, you know, people whom you didn't like were marginalized. And typically people who were associated with the Nazis and with Auschwitz and things like that. And I don't think that the term fascism is really an expression that people on the right are using to stigmatize the left. I think everyone who uses the word fascism knows it means some kind of right-wing devil that can be associated with Nazi atrocities. You know, whence we have Islamofascism, Trump as a fascist, whoever we don't like becomes a fascist. And if you read my book, you discover most of it has to do with anti-fascism, because I think fascism is a fairly cut-and-dry thing, which a number of highly competent historians have written on. And it is basically an interwar European phenomenon. It is not something which is alive and well in Arab countries. It is not alive and well in the United States today. And I argue it is basically a Latin phenomenon. Which, you know, can be, in the interwar period, is exportable to other cultures that are influenced by some of the same ideas. So you have right-wing Zionists who are attracted to Mussolini. You even have black followers of Mussolini. The followers of Marcus Garvey are great fans of Mussolini. But this is very much, I see, as a kind of interwar European phenomenon, which develops partly in reaction to the First World War, the mobilization of the war, the disappointment of the losing side, and also in the case of Italy, the side that won but didn't win enough from the war. So they turned to fascism, which is a revolutionary nationalist ideology, which usually has some kind of expansionist or irredentist element attached to it. Now, and this, in my opinion, has nothing to do with obnoxious Arab terrorists, who may be obnoxious, but they're not fascists. It has nothing whatever to do with Donald Trump, who has about as much connection to fascism as my pet basset hound. But, you know, the term just gets thrown around. And when neoconservatives use it, they most definitely mean people who are anti-Semitic and on the right. This is why they're using it. And they're appealing basically to a kind of leftist audience, which shudders when they hear the word fascism. So for these reasons, I became interested. And of course, the work that Bob is looking at does allow me to get back into one of my pet peeves, which is the Frankfurt School, cultural Marxism, because I believe cultural Marxism, which emphasizes anti-fascism, has become the dominant ideology of our age, just as fascism was the dominant ideology in the 1920s and early 1930s. Anti-fascism, also known as cultural Marxism, has become a dominant idea in our age, which permeates the political spectrum. So that when people discuss gay rights, they get bleary-eyed and talk about all the prejudice, of the people who oppose this. And you hear this in the conservative movement, when they're not denouncing Islamofascism. So that certainly the left is entirely cultural Marxist. I do not consider Bernie Sanders to be primarily a socialist. He's primarily a cultural Marxist radical who believes in Black Lives Matter, feminism, gay rights. This is the entire cultural Marxist agenda is what he represents. So, these people for a very long time.
One thing I've heard on Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders' original focus was primarily economic, but a lot of these social justice warriors types have really put a lot of pressure on him.
Right.
They've actually attacked him for not being pro-immigration enough, and they've sort of pressured him to go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But his core principles are primarily more of the class issues, income and equality,
right,
rather than cultural issues.
Can I make a jump in here? When you
go
said
ahead.
They were attacking him for not being hard enough on open borders immigration, it's funny, there was this Vox interview with Ezra Klein. Klein asks him about open borders immigration, and Sanders says he's opposed to it, and Klein is basically aghast and gives him the typical little speech about restaurants and all the other benefits of open borders immigration, and Sanders continues to say he's opposed to it because it's a right-wing scheme, a far-right scheme, and he goes on to call the Koch brothers far-right, which I think is kind of funny, and and he just basically goes on to why it's a right-wing thing he's opposed to it, and now he seems to be more and more in favor of those things.
Well, but he was giving you the traditional communist position. The French Communist Party, after World War II, violently opposed immigration from Africa because it would hurt the French working class. I mean, this is a classical Marxist position. The cultural Marxists are exactly the opposite. They believe in multiculturalism. And they see economic issues as less important than cultural and social issues. If you read my book, The Strange Death of European Marxism, that the argument is that Marxism and traditional socialism have been supplanted by cultural Marxism. And you see this in Germany. All these former communists are running to embrace gay rights and feminism and open borders. These were not positions they held when they were communists.
Yeah. In your book, Encounters, you go over the three types of leftists, saying like the old world European Jews, the New York Jews who basically have the fear of anti-Semitism,
right,
and then the PC Gentile who are the third group. And when you're saying that one, yes, and basically they're the ones who shudder the most at fascism. I would assume.
Right.
I would assume that they're the ones who shudder the most.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Bernie Sanders Do you feel that he started out at type 1 and slowly was just going to become
I think you're right. I think he may have gone from 1, 2 to 3.
Yes,
I think he the whole spectrum.
Yes, yes.
I think a perfect example of this is Hillary Clinton gave a speech, and in response to Bernie Sanders, she said, it doesn't matter if we break up the big banks if we don't fail to fight racism and gender inequality.
Sorry, I had to,
No, I always tell people if I have to choose between, I don't know, the old Communist Party of France or Italy and Hillary Clinton, I'd pick the Communist every time. I mean,
The term Marxists refer to them, but their key issue is not so much they don't care that much about economic Marxism. In a lot of cases, their economic worldview is much closer to neoliberalism.
Well, the cultural Marxists they start out in Germany, the Frankfurter Schule in the interwar period. They talk a bit about economics, and they pretend, you know, they are socialists of some kind, but the emphasis is always on the psychological and cultural effects of capitalism, and you know how it causes gender inequality and homophobia and so forth. Then what happens over time is the economic issues are given a back seat. So some European radicals who are traditional radicals have argued that that all of cultural Marxism is a bourgeois plot. It's a bourgeois decadent plot, and it's an attempt to prevent true socialism from coming to the fore. Now, if you notice the Republican Party and Fox News, the Republican Party, they're always going after Sanders not for the social cultural issues, but because he is a big government socialist or something like that. So they pretty much will concede the social issues to the cultural Marxist side. They just want to talk about, free enterprise, what remains of free enterprise, or something about, this policy will cause our taxes to go up. So, they pretty much concede all the cultural Marxist issues to the other side.
Yeah, it seems like they're basically pandering to the left on Fox News, trying to
win
people over. And, if you watch Red Eye, which is their more, libertarian show or something, it's a bit more culturally relevant per se.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys on there will be like, hey, I love Martin Luther King, but this thing, it doesn't mean this. Like they'll continually push forward how they are sort of leftist culturally, at least sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's like the major problem. They just are constantly pandering to win over leftists, but not on cultural issues.
Right. And some of these people who support leftist causes like Soros or some of the other sort of major backers, the fellow who owns Starbucks and so forth, I doubt they're socialists of any kind. They're just cultural radicals, cultural, social, anti-nationalist radicals of some kind, anti-fascist, if you will. But I don't think they're drawn to their leftist causes because the people at Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankenfein, I doubt that he's interested in creating a socialist society.
Sure a lot of them would view like a Bernie Sanders type movement as a threat because he's talking about a massive increase on their taxes and breaking up the banks.
Yeah. I don't know. I think Blankenfein from Goldman Sachs is a big Hillary Clinton supporter. I think typically these people like Hillary because she seems to be radical on the cultural issues, but it's not going to hurt their pocketbooks or their earnings very much.
Well, Sanders, he'll talk about these economic things, and auditing the Fed was a big thing for a while. And
right.
He and Ron Paul were doing this basically just bipartisan – taking a bipartisan approach to auditing the Fed, and then, like, the last minute, Bernie dropped out of it. So
right.
I think they pose these economic changes, and they know that they're really not going to do that, but they'll win their audience over on the cultural issues.
Yes, exactly.
So that's why Sanders is less of a threat, really, because they know
mm-hmm.
they cannot get him on the economics. He'll do the cultural stuff.
Right. I totally agree. Sanders is not going to be taken serious on the economic issue. The other thing about him is I don't hear any traditional socialism. I mean, what he is like a saphead who's going to give away a lot of goodies to the kiddies. They're going to get free universities, more student loans, everything will be given to them. I mean, this is not socialism. I mean, socialism, usually you have graded system of advancement. You have to pass examinations to get into a university. I mean, just look at how the Marxists ran things. This has nothing to do with it. I mean, there was a kind of almost Mandarin system that they created. It didn't work very effectively, but you know, it wasn't that everything was open to everyone, and they certainly were not tolerant of gays. I mean, gays even now are being persecuted in Castro's Cuba.
The left went through the three stages. There's the original traditional Marxist, and then you have sort of the left as it is today, which is sort of the cultural leftism emerged with neoliberalism. I think Sanders, what he represents, is really like the 60s era left.
Right, right. No, I think you're right. Sanders went through all three stages. You know, I think you're right. I mean, it's the neoliberalism with more giveaway programs and, you know, the cultural radicalism. I think that's what he represents in a particularly, shall we say, strong form, which is very appealing to the millennial generation.
And it seems on foreign policy he reflects neoliberalism in that, like, he increasingly sees Putin as a threat. So that's the neocon line.
I don't think Sanders buys into this neocon line on foreign policy. I think he's pretty much the same as Obama. We're going to sort of let things drift along.
If you compare Hillary and Obama, I think Hillary Clinton would be far more hawkish and adopt a more neocon foreign policy than Obama did.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, that's why some of these neocons have begun to make a beeline toward her, like Robert Kagan. You know, I mean, they understand that she's gonna let them occupy positions, you know, in her government. With Sanders, there isn't much of a chance that they'll get anywhere.
I also think Trump has the appeal of challenging Clinton on issues that could appeal to people on the left that. He can challenge Clinton on the Iraq War, on NAFTA, on Wall Street issues.
Yeah, he'll probably try something like that. I think that somebody asked, do I back Trump? The answer is very, very reluctantly. I don't particularly trust the man. I think his conversion is largely a sham, I wish he could, you know, curb his tongue a bit more. I've been sort of nicer to him in English than I have been in German. I've written several German articles in German about him, in which I've been very critical of his verbal intemperance. I mean, he should be stopping these tweeting. He should try to get along with Cruz or some of these other people in the party. And he just, stop insulting Megyn Kelly, as obnoxious as she is. I think this is a serious character flaw, and I'm also upset that, you know, he cannot be more coherent. I mean, I've heard, you know, I'll make America great again, you're all incredible people. I mean, he should do at least some more than he's doing of what some of the other candidates are doing, which is outlining a policy, you know, in intelligible English, and as I said, you know, if possible in whole sentences. I know his shtick. I've seen it already, but I want to see something more presidential.
He does give different speeches to different groups. I listened to his AIPAC speech, and it sounds like the kind of things that a neoconservative would want to hear.
It was about how
we have to crack down on Iran and how Iran is the most dangerous country in the world. On the other hand, he said things like, I can get along with Putin, and that we're better off letting Assad in Syria than having ISIS take over. So you're not primarily pro-Trump. You just think that the fact that he's making these neocons and establishment types really squeam, that he's really just that alone means that he's doing something really, really remarkable.
If you ask me what's my view, it's a second view. I mean, I'm delighted that he's making these people squirm. I think they're loathsome. I'm very happy that he's doing these things. You know, if he could bring down National Review, I'd be even happier. You know, I mean, I think that in order to have a coherent, serious right in this country, it is necessary to get rid of the neoconservatives and get rid of what my friend Peter Brimmel calls conservatism incorporated, and you know, have a Republican establishment that doesn't have a controlling interest in what conservatives believe, but you know, is one would say most influenced by it. No, I think the conservative movement. If you read my books, you know, I believe it has gone in a horrible direction since the 1980s. And it's becoming worse and worse. So for this, I'm grateful for Trump. And you know, I would vote for him at this point. But I'm under no illusions about, you know, the sincerity of his conversion, or you know, whether he's saying consistently saying things I believe, because I am convinced that, you know, he'll turn on a dime and say exactly the opposite depending on his advantage. And the speech he gave at AIPAC did not impress me at all. I thought it was not statesmanlike. Contrary to what Charles Krauthammer said, I did not think it was statesmanlike. It was not something I would care to hear from a future, you know, presidential candidate or somebody enjoying the nomination of one of our two parties. You know, he could have defended the state of Israel without sounding as frenetic as he did.
That's the thing is that Trump is very pro-Israel. And on a lot of issues, despite all that, the neocons have this visceral hatred of him.
They do.
I think the key issue is not so much the – I think he's sufficiently pro-Israel. I don't think that's the key issue. I think one of them – I think the number one is that he symbolizes a resurgence of nationalism and populism, and that really makes him uncomfortable. The other issue is he's made comments saying that he can get along with Putin, and neocons
–
have a visceral hatred of Russia. And I noticed about his comments on banning Muslim immigration, I noticed that the neocons are actually divided about that. Some neocons have attacked those remarks, but there are some neocons who agree with him, like David Horowitz, Front Page Magazine. He's very much a neocon on foreign policy, but on immigration issues, like he supports banning Muslim immigration. So I think on some issues there's different factions of the neoconservatives.
I would not overemphasize the differences. It is remarkable how often they sound the same. You know, like if the issue is the Confederate flag, you know, they compete with each other on who wants to tear down more of them or remove Robert E. Lee's name from more buildings and so forth. They seem to have identical sensibilities on immigration. They're all pro immigration. The Muslim thing, of course, gets into the question of Zionism in Israel. You know, we know how they feel about this. But you know, they're generally this. Every time I turn on Fox, I'm listening to these people saying that, you know, America was created to provide refuge and letting everybody in the world come in, and we're a propositional nation. And these are all neoconservative. They're vintage neoconservative positions. I don't see that on the question of Putin. I mean, there is a story. I agree. They hate the Russians. They hate the Russians probably more than any other group except the Germans and the Arabs. You know, they're probably like in third place.
The neocons have been supporting these separatists in Ukraine, and these groups actually are, I mean, we've talked about calling people a fascist as a pejorative. A lot of these people are actually outright neo-Nazis, but they're supporting them just because they're anti-Putin. So they have no ideological consistency whatsoever.
Probably the worst history of anti-Semitism of any country in Europe. But, you know, as soon as Russia became the enemy, they became pro-Ukrainian. Yeah, I know. It is interesting. I mean, once Russia became the enemy, you know, they stopped attacking the Poles. They stopped attacking the Ukrainians, all the other Eastern European Slavic countries they thought were anti-Semitic. You know, the Russians became the – I can't see them ever – becoming, I think the Germans are perhaps a kind of, you know, the ultimate enemy in their mind because of the Nazis. But, you know, as I say, I think Russia is way up there. And all these other countries are willing to compromise. They haven't said anything nice about Orban because he's a right-wing Hungarian nationalist and therefore a fascist. But you think they would agree with him on the migrants, but they haven't come out for him. He's a gutsy man, I have to say. He's my favorite European leader right now. And, you know, he does have the courage to stand up to the EU and to keep those migrants out.
Did you hear Orban's speech, his recent speech about keeping the migrants out?
Excuse me?
Did you hear Orban's most recent speech?
Oh, yes, I did.
It's,
I mean, I read it in English.
Sure.
Poor.
Oh, yes, no, I had subtitles at the bottom.
Right.
One interesting point, he's talking about, you know, everything that he – that you know, how bringing in all these migrants would essentially change the culture of Hungary and
mm-hmm.
the things that they'd bring with them. You know, women wouldn't be safe in the street on the streets at night. And he also brings up and they'll bring homophobia. And I think that's pretty interesting because
right.
Orban is seen as this fascist, extreme conservative figure, you know, who's bringing about traditionalism in Hungary, but he's still kind of protecting essentially, you know, an untraditional idea like homosexuality. So
you would never hear Orban defending homosexuality. He's violently against gay rights. I think he's a very conservative Protestant. His father was a Calvinist minister. The Calvinists in Hungary are the national party. It's the national religion is Calvinism. The same
but
as
he
the
still
Dutch.
Wanted to stop homophobia, though. From
did he
migrants.
Say he was against homophobia?
He said that the migrants will bring danger to our women and children. They will bring homophobia.
That's interesting because
yeah.
he has done everything he can
I know.
To keep gay
I know.
Rights.
I think exactly. He'll be against gay rights until someone he likes doesn't like is against gay rights. And then he's
even
sort
of
he's
for becoming
it.
A neocon now.
<Yeah.
right? laughs> That's very disappointing to learn.
Well, maybe it was a bad translation.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's possible. I remember seeing the great turn on Buckley, William Buckley, when, you know, for years he deplored Castro's persecution of Christians and anti-American, and then he began having people on who, you know, spoke about how he persecutes gays and this or women's issues. And that when Buckley was turning in that direction, I knew he was, you know, his anti-communism had changed. As I said, he had gone from right-wing anti-communism to left-wing anti-communism.
Interesting. I mean, you even see with Marine Le Pen, who is, you know, dubbed as the fascist nationalist in France, who is all for feminism, as all for gay rights.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it's become increasingly difficult to depict Marine Le Pen as any kind of fascist. I mean, she's making so many compromises with everybody. She kicked her father out of the movement.
Yeah. Basically, anyone, their definition of fascism is just nationalism or anyone who opposes mass immigration. But getting back to the sort of definition of fascism, I think it can be very complex to define because earlier on you were saying that you had sort of the original fascism and then you had Hitler's version. Most people associate fascism with Hitler.
Right.
He had his own ideology, which is separate from Italian fascism. I think if you asked maybe your average sort of liberal intellectual how to define fascism, not like your typical sort of like social justice warrior type, but someone who is fairly a little bit more somewhat thoughtful, they might say fascism is just an authoritarian version of a nationalism that's very right-wing. That's probably what they'd say.
Yeah, by the way, in my book, I never deny that fascism is a movement of the right. I agree with traditional Marxists. It developed as a counter-revolutionary movement in countries that are threatened by socialist revolution. And I agree with Ernst Nolte that it is a counter-revolutionary movement that imitates the left by, you know, appearing to be a revolution. But, you know, it develops in a particular time and in a particular place, and not every counter-revolutionary movement that imitates the left is fascism. I also very carefully distinguish fascism from Nazism. I think they're two very different movements. Nazism is obviously more demonic, more murderous. But, you know, fascism is not a racist movement. When you ask, you know, Mussolini to define race, he gives you some sort of vague understanding. They're not white nationalists.
Even Franco in Spain, I mean, he wasn't even anti-Semitic. He gave refuge to Jews who were fleeing persecution.
But he also was not a fascist. He was never a fascist. He was a military dictator, you know, who starts out as a supporter of the Spanish Republic and then allies himself with the Catholic Church because the Republic goes people go crazy killing priests and nuns. So the Catholic Church rallies, a kind of crusade, and he identifies with it. And, you know, for political purposes, he becomes, you know, a defender of the absolute right of the Catholic Church in Spain, unless it stepped on his toes, in which case he went after it. But he was never a fascist. I mean, he tried to appropriate for a while the symbols of the Falange, which were the Spanish fascist movement. Which was, by the way, very, very much of a kind of Latin Catholic, you know, fascist movement. The fascists are also not radical socialists. With all due respect to Jonah Goldberg, who deserves no respect at all, but you know, they are in fact not radical socialists. They are, they sort of tinker, create a kind of minor welfare state, give the workers and the owners of industry special fascist, corporatist titles. They don't change very much. Practice. They're an authoritarian movement of the right, post-conservative. They're not traditional conservatives. And you know, if the war had not occurred, we would have had fascist regimes lingering on in Second World countries for maybe another generation. Then they would have gone. It is a secondary or tertiary historical movement.
Would you say that Mussolini is probably like the most pure form of fascism?
Well, I mean, Mussolini's Italy is the only example I can think of fascism in practice. Is there any other? I mean, they ran the country for like a number of years. I think after 1938, they pretty much come under German control. But, you know, from 1922 to up to into the 30s, you know, you have a fascist government in Italy. It is not anti-Semitic. There's a disproportionately large number of Jews who are fascist members of the Grand Council. Remember, it's only in 1938, after he decides to make an alliance with Hitler, that Mussolini bans Jews from certain professions and from the fascist movement. So, you know, that 16-year period, you know, you have a lot of Jews who are. And in the 30s, early 30s, mid-30s, he took a strong position against Hitler, you know, and against the Nazis, and sponsored the Zionist movement. He was a hero to the Zionists back then. So, I mean, Mussolini has many faces.
Do you think that it's only Hitler that's like why fascism is seen as inherently anti-Semitic? Like people think fascism equals anti-Semitism.
Well, no. But remember, all the regimes that support Hitler are violently anti-Semitic, and not all of them. Very few of them are fascist. Most of the collaborative governments that deal with Hitler are opportunist. Some are military dictatorships. Others are leftists who simply changed, you know, simply joined the Nazi movement. But, you know, they're simply collaborators. Very few of the collaborators were still fascist. And even in the case of Mussolini's Italy, the fascist movement only becomes really vicious after Mussolini is restored to power by the Germans in 1943, and the Salo Republic is pretty much run by the Waffen-SS afterwards. But the anti-Semitism of the Vichy government in France, or the anti-Semitism of, let's say the Ustache in Croatia. I mean, these aren't really traditional fascist groups. And they're groups that just take power because the Germans need collaborators when they occupy the countries. Salusi in Hungary, the Arrow Cross, leader of the Arrow Cross, they're violent. They kill all the Jews they get their hands on. But they're only in power for a few months. They are not traditional Hungarian fascists. The fascists were in power in Hungary in the 1930s. They were mildly anti-Semitic, not very much. But, you know, they're pretty much just thrown out. And then you simply get the crazies taking over, who are the German collaborators in 1944 when the Germans occupy Hungary.
What are your thoughts on different movements outside of Europe that were influenced by fascism? You gave one example with Jabotinsky in Israel. Other examples
right.
are the Hindutva movement in India, which was like radical Hindu
exactly.
nationalism. There was the Arab Baath Party. Also, what is it called? The Kutub Party in Lebanon, which was a Christian movement during the Civil War,
which
was also influenced by fascism.
Right, right. Yeah, no, the... There's no question that when fascism looks like it's going to be a successful movement, you got all these mini fascisms developing. Now, the question is, you know, is third world fascism the same as European fascism? Well, in the case of Lebanon, it might be, because these are, you know, Frenchified Catholic Arabs. But, you know, if you look at India, probably there's less of a resemblance. But, you know, I'm obviously Jabotinsky was greatly a great admirer of Mussolini. And, you know, the Jews were Europeans, and they were influenced by Latin fascism. So, you know, they look pretty much like them. So I think, again, it depends on how culturally similar the groups are to the European fascists. But it is a very fashionable model in the 1920s and 1930s. Remember, Cole Porter has in his song, Mussolini is the tops. he had to change that line later. But fascism seems to be, the movement of the future. And we might say that, you know, to whatever extent the Germans Hitler uses fascist symbols. I mean, this looks like, you know, the up-and-coming movement of the time. Just as, you know, after the Second World War, countries become either, you know, try to resemble the Soviet Union or the United States, because those are the dominant powers. So certainly in the interwar period, fascism is important. And remember, Mussolini is like running a second-rate, you know, it's a poor country, but poor military in comparison to other European countries. But as leader of the fascist movement, he has a kind of international resonance.
In your book, you also talk about sort of offshoots of fascism that are maybe a little bit more to the left economically. You talk about the Strasser brothers. You talk about Father
right.
Coughlin in America.
Yeah, no, those are really different, sort of qualitatively different imitators. The Strasser brothers in Germany, the Black Front, and these people, or someone like Ernst Niekisch, who was the head of the National Bolsheviks, what was in German, the National Bolshevisten or something. What are they called? I think they're not the other one is the Schwarze Front, the Black Front, and they're sort of influenced by Mussolini, but they're all like losers. I mean, they talk about revolutionary nationalism and some kind of authoritarian government. They all got wiped out by the Nazis. Or almost all. I think Otto Strasser manages to survive until after the war. His brother Gregor is killed. Niekisch survives in a concentration camp, later becomes a figure in the East German communist government. Father Coughlin is sort of strange because he's essentially a radical New Deal Democrat who is against the war, is against war. He begins attacking Jews in Wall Street. Then after the Second World War, he disappears back into the Democratic Party, and in 1960 was a John F. Kennedy supporter. So, you know, someone like Oswald Mosley is fascinating, the head of the British Fascist Party. And, he's at the most, he was a great political leader. I mean, he could have become Prime Minister of England, but then he begins playing around with the fascist movement. And as I argue in my book, it never does well in England because it is so culturally different. I mean, it's basically a kind of Catholic collectivist movement which doesn't do well in a Protestant individualist bourgeois society or something. And he's simply looked upon as a curiosity in England. And then during the war, he's treated quite badly. He was a totally harmless man. And I think Winston Churchill actually got him released because he had been an admirer of his. But you could see that the fascism doesn't go very well in some countries. It doesn't go well in the United States. It always looks like an import here. But, you know, a country like Romania, which has, a bad economy, The Romanians think they're really Latins, although they're not. They're Dacian Slavic people, but they try to Latinize their language. They take the sort of Roman mythology. So, you know, they're going to be attracted to the fascist movement. The Iron Guard in Romania are among the nastiest imitators because they are violently anti-Semitic. But they don't last very long because they're so obnoxious that the government simply kills them off in the end. The Romanian government in the Second World War was not run by the Iron Guard. It was run by Antonescu, who was a military dictator.
Was the Iron Guard mostly a students group? I've heard that.
Yeah.
It's like run by college students.
Right, right. And
so
Antonescu's wife was Jewish, strangely enough, but he didn't make anti-Semitic speeches. But hardly any of the Jews were touched there because they just paid him off, so they were left alone. Romania was not only a horrible government, it was also the most corrupt government. You could bribe the government.
In your book, you talk about the denazification process and that happened in Germany after the war. And you have the Soviet thing in East Germany, but you focus on what the American puppet regime does. And I'd like you to explain more about that in detail, but one interesting thing that's interesting about that is Austria sort of escaped that. And I think today Austria has a lot more nationalistic than Germany is. If you look at the migrant crisis, Germany is totally screwed. I think Austria is beginning to show a little bit of a backbone, and I think that whole sort of the original history is part of the reason why Austria and Germany are different today.
Well, you know, you do have the same political culture in Austria that you have in Germany. I've always said that, you know, the Austrians sort of get away with this and they don't do them what they did the Germans, but the Austrian academic political culture is just as bad as it is in Germany. They blame themselves for World War One. They see themselves as even more blameworthy for the Nazis than the Germans. The newspapers all lay the same kind of guilt trip on the population that they do in Germany. It just hasn't gone quite that far. It just hasn't sunk in as deeply. And I think you're right. The Austrians do show more backbone, and they vote for the Die Freiheitliche Partei Österreichs, which is, you know, a right-of-center party. You have no right-of-center party going anywhere in Germany. I mean, even the Alternative für Deutschland is well to the left of the Freiheitliche Partei Österreich, and it's considered to be like a neo-Nazi party. They look like, you know, Republican establishment types to me.
And then you have the NDP is totally marginalized as a fascist party.
Oh yeah, totally marginalized. You mean the Nationaldemokraten? They're pretty much gone, except in parts of East Germany. East Germany is more conservative, and the reason is that the Soviet regime was more conservative. The Soviet government that took over did not lay cultural Marxist guilt trips, and they also defined fascism as capitalism, rather than as, you know, the evil German character or something like that, or German history. They didn't bother to blame Germany for World War One or the Franco-Prussian War or stuff like that. The West German government, on the other hand, was like violently anti-national and anti-German, or became that way. Certainly the Adenauer regime wasn't like that, but by the 1980s it was like that. The East German communists, on the other hand, they were a Soviet puppet regime. But, you know, if the Germans wanted to be nationalists, as long as it was compatible with Soviet interests, that was okay. You know, if they wanted to glorify Frederick the Great as an early Soviet communist, that was fine with them, or Luther or somebody like that. Whereas the West Germans would just beat up on their entire national past. So I think the East Germans came out, they're mentally healthier than the people lived under the Anglo-American democratic aegis.
Can you give some examples of the propaganda tactics that were used in that post-war period?
Where? In West Germany or East Germany?
in the West Germany by the U.S.
In West
puppet
Germany,
government.
You have a total cultural Marxist indoctrination occurring for several years, as I point out in my book, in terms of who got licenses to publish things, what was taught in school, rewriting textbooks. The left that you now see that's taken over in Germany, you know, was really put on its feet by the Americans after World War II, during this period of denazification. And the best book on this was written by a man named Schrenk Notzing, and it's called The Brainwashing of the Germans. something like Das Gehirnwaschen des Deutschen, or something like that. I have it here. It sort of describes the depth or the degree to which this re-education took place. Strangely enough, it didn't have that much impact until, you know, maybe the late 60s or the 1970s. That's when you begin seeing the effects of this. German newspapers change. They become much more leftist than they had been before. Particularly after the Cold War starts, the American government pretty much gives up the efforts to re-educate Germans. And you do have, you know, national conservative papers in Germany. Someone like Axel Springer, the Springer Verlag, back then was very conservative, very pro-national, but it was also pro-Israel and pro-American, because Springer was part Jewish. But, I mean, you know, it was possible to be all these things in Germany. But then from the sort of the 1970s on, after the 68ers take over, the country is going to become very anti-fascist and very anti-German and very radical on cultural issues. And that has continued down to the present. So the denazification has a kind of delayed effect in Germany. I mean, it cannot be seen, you know, in 1948 or 1950 so much as in 1990 or 2000.
Do you think the United States has gone through a simultaneous denazification?
I think the United States has moved exactly in the same direction.
Exactly,
with only one difference, that we don't hate our country. Like in Germany, you say, you know, we have to let all the migrants come in so we cease to be Germans because we're in a horrible country. Whereas the United States, we do crazy things because that's what America's about. That's
sure.
Who we are as Americans, right? We have
but
to let, you know, everybody come in. We have to have a gay marriage. You beat
mm-hmm.
up on the Christians who won't bake the cake for the gay wedding because that's what we Americans are. That's what the country's always been about.
And they say that's not who we are is the motto.
Yeah.
But I do think there is because people tend to see America as a propositional nation. Because
right.
you'll see these null indicative sort of like whiteness is a disease, whiteness needs to die.
Right.
These ideas, because I'm 26 years old, many people I know are completely brainwashed and indoctrinated into that way of thinking. So.
Well, but the other thing
yes.
you're not going to see in Germany is something like a Trump movement. You know, there is like, you know, 30 to 40% of this country that I think is, you know, is on the right. In Germany, if it were, you know, 2%, I'd be surprised. It's pretty dim picture there. Maybe in Austria, there's the same percentage as there is here. No, I think like in the United States, you do have a solid, large minority on the right that are against
silent.
Multiculturalism, against the open borders, has some sense, you know, of what used to be the bourgeois order. And, you know, I don't think anything like this exists in Germany or Sweden.
I think what's going on in Germany is that not everyone supports what's going on, but I think a lot of people, they're unhappy about it, but they don't really have the courage to openly challenge it.
Beyond that, in Germany, they vote for leftist parties that are even crazier than Merkel to show they're dissatisfied with Merkel. They vote for the Greens.
It's important to point out about Merkel is she actually originally ran as a conservative, and I remember a while back, like in the Bush era, American conservatives, when she got elected, were talking about how great it was that Germany now is a conservative prime minister.
Well, but it was not true. Merkel was never there. It was never a conservative of any kind. And as a matter of fact, she worked for the East German communist government up until the last moment, you know, and then became she's sort of, you know, a fiscally austere, whatever the term was, sort of cultural Marxist, which is what she has remained. But from the standpoint of the neoconservative, she's a great conservative German. She's anti-national, totally submissive to the United States. She'll do what we want. That makes her conservative. You know, that's the only kind of conservative they want. They would not want a national conservative, a German nationalist in power. But she was never conservative of any kind. She was a communist for most of her career. Her parents are fanatical communists.
What do the neocons think about someone like Geert Wilders? Because on one hand, he's anti-immigration, but on the other hand, he's very pro-Israel and pro-American and socially liberal.
Yeah, I don't know. They if being anti-immigration means keeping out anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic Muslims, they probably would favor it, right? But the who is the are you referring to the leader in Holland?
Yes,
Geert Wilders. Yeah, Dutch. No, he is. He's actually on the left on every single cultural issue, gay rights, feminism, you know. He just wants to keep the Muslims out because they threaten. He sees they threaten his liberal social agenda. And he's consistent about it. But, you know, I think he's perceived as a far rightist because of his stand on the Muslims. I don't know what is their reaction. I haven't been following them on Geert Wilders. I can't imagine they'd find him objectionable because, you know, they would agree with his criticism of Muslims coming in.
In America, neocons tend to be pro-immigration.
Right.
But do they make an exception for restricting Muslims, or do you say...
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, I've been reading Max Boot and Jonah Goldberg and others, and their argument is, in America, Muslims fit in perfectly, and we should do nothing to prevent them from coming in, unless, you know, they have documentable backgrounds as terrorists. But, you know, they're all in favor of it, and they're beating up on Trump as a fascist because he doesn't take the same. But somehow, when they come into the United States, it's okay, because we assimilate them into our propositionalism or something like that. I think that's the neocon position on this. Whereas it's bad in Europe, but it's good here.
Do you think some of the parties in Europe, like Golden Dawn in Greece and Jobbik, do you think they're influenced by fascism?
Well, in the case of the Golden Dawn in Greece, I mean, they have gone out of their way to pick up. It's not only fascist stuff. I mean, they picked up Nazi stuff. And, you know, I think in practice they're none of these things. But, you know, it is interesting that they feel free to draw on all of these unsavory symbols of the past.
Yeah.
I think that they have no chance of taking over. I mean, the problem there is Syriza and the crazies on the left.
Does fascism become an aesthetic choice?
I think you're right. It's an aesthetic choice because it is historically irrelevant. So the symbols are nice. You know, in my book on fascism, you know, I like their iconography.
Cool.
I think Italian iconography, fascist iconography is great. I love this stuff. They didn't run
the country
very well.
Do you know Augustus Invictus? He's running for Libertarian Senate in Florida.
No, I do not.
He's frequently called a fascist, and he actually uses the Mussolini eagle as his symbol.
That's very good. Now, no one has noticed that the cover of my book, which is absolutely beautiful, has the flag of the Salo Republic, which was a nasty piece of business. But they have beautiful flags, a beautiful flag. And we very often associate with Italian fascism is the flag of the Salo Republic, which is on my book. They have very, very attractive symbols, and I like La Giovinezza, their party song. I play it all the time, Italian fascist song. You also have people saying they're anarcho-fascist. My friend Hans Hermann Hoppe, who's German, he lives in Turkey, says he's ich bin anarcho-fascistisch. You know, it's like combine the two. So it doesn't mean anything anymore. I've argued it's, you know, it's a kind of aesthetic, symbolic thing at most.
Would you say Pinochet is a fascist?
No.
But he's
no
aesthetic fascist, though.
He's not even an aesthetic fascist. I met Pinochet. I was invited to Chile when he was in power, and someone had just tried to assassinate him and his grandson. He looked like a very scared old man at the time. No, he was a kind of, you know, military dictator caretaker or something like that. but he's not a fascist. Someone like Juan Perón, on the other hand, you know, in Argentina, does play around with fascist symbols for a while, you know, and is a great admirer of Mussolini, and for a while he says nice things about Hitler, and then he comes back as a Maoist in his last incarnation. Because, you know, he was always anti-American, so the Americans didn't like he was the opposite. I think Vargas, who was the dictator for a while in Brazil, took over some kind of fascist corporatist model when that was popular in the early 1940s. But in the answer about Pinochet, there's nothing that would suggest to me that he's a fascist.
With fascism and the career of a concept, would you make the argument that we're better off sort of discarding the whole concept of fascism? It just, if people can't define it, should we just drop it altogether? Or do you think it's worth that people at least understand what fascism is? But it's definitely way overused.
Well, no. My book, you know, is a scholarly effort to argue, you know, that unless we want to discuss fascism as a scholarly research problem, let's not use the word anymore. I mean, that's my argument throughout the book, because what it has become now is, at best, you know, inflammatory rhetoric, and at worst, an excuse for left-wing totalitarianism. To be quite blunt about what I'm arguing, because I think the anti-fascist cultural Marxists are the greatest totalitarian threat that we face in the West. It is not the Muslims. It is these cultural Marxist PC maniacs who have taken over.
Are Muslim extremists kind of like the weapon of the cultural Marxists?
No, I think what is going to happen is since the cultural Marxists don't want to fight the Muslim extremists, they're just going to let them come in, and they might become totally destructive and wreck everything in the end.
At what point do they stop making excuses, though, for them?
Excuse me?
At what point do you think the cultural Marxist types would stop making excuses for terrorist behavior?
Oh, I don't think they will. I think they'll go on doing this because they hate white Christian Westerners.
Bill Maher is basically on board with all that stuff you're talking about, cultural Marxism, bashing white people. But when it comes to radical Islam, like he makes, that's like the one issue he comes out and says, radical Islam is a major threat. Bill Maher, you talk a lot about neoconservatives who use liberal arguments to go after radical Islam, but Bill Maher is probably the only person who's explicitly on the left who makes those arguments.
There are a couple people like that, like this guy Dave Rubin, who was kicked off the Young Turks.
Right.
And Sam Harris will frequently talk, you know, he's basically a leftist, I guess, and he'll talk about radical Islam. So there is a kind of a movement there, but I think that comes out of atheism and humanism.
Right, right. They justify it by saying that, you know, Islam, you know, is the latest form of Christianity, or, you know, Christian intolerance is now migrated to the Islamic world. Curiously, they'll never say that Muslims are bad in themselves. It's sort of like they picked up, you know, the fanaticism of Christian theists or something like that. They're very careful not to really I would never mistake them for the Gates of Vienna or what is this man, Spence, who's or Spence is his name. The one was always
Robert Spencer.
Robert Spencer, right, declaiming against Islam as, you know, as a peculiarly evil religion. The atheists don't do that. I mean, they seem to still hate the Christians the most, but, you know, they do make a place for Islam, you know, in their demonology, and I think they do recognize that, you know, radical. Christopher Hitchens was the same.
Yeah, I think people like Hitchens and Harris feel that Islam is on a trajectory in the same way that, you know, Christianity was on a trajectory, and that Islam will hit a reformation at some point. You know, there's the people like Majid Nawaz who are, you know,
Muslim reformers. By the way, I always find the comparison to the Reformation ridiculous. I mean, the people who made the Protestant Reformation were devout Christians who didn't think the Catholics were Christian enough. You know, I mean, it's, you know, they were in some ways the intense zealots. It wasn't that they were getting rid of Christianity.
Yeah, so their goal was to their reformation of Islam is probably Islam and cultural Marxism combining into a new religion. So
I think you can say the Protestant Reformation had a positive effect on Western. I think it did, but you know it's to depict these people as predecessors of Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris is ridiculous.
But the key issue with Islam is how to react, because obviously in Europe what's going on is clearly an issue of immigration. After 9/11, how we responded to the threat of radical Islam was not – we basically – 9/11 was exploited to have all these really disastrous wars in the Middle East. So
right.
Anti-Muslim sentiment in its pure form – it's not so much, it's not inherently a good thing. It's like reacting to it in an intelligent way, because a lot of people, like after 9/11, it was like, yeah, let's like go over there, let's like bomb the shit out of all those towel heads and stuff like that. You have to come up with a coherent way of dealing with this. And obviously what's going on in Europe right now is purely the key issue is just stopping the flow of the migrants coming in. So it's how you deal with these issues instead of just saying – it's easy to say, yeah, I'm anti-Muslim or I'm against radical Islam.
Yeah, I was actually taken aback by the violent reaction to Trump's statement that, at least for the time being, let's not let more Muslims come into – I thought it was perfectly reasonable what he was saying. But, I was thinking back even to an earlier point when you had 9/11 – and Bush is like running around to celebrate Ramadan, in the White House. And I'm thinking that, the attack of the Japanese on Pearl Harbor, it may actually have been, we may have been more responsible for what the Muslims did. But as far as I know, President Roosevelt did not have a special Buddhist service or, Japanese form of Buddhism being practiced in the White House the day after Pearl Harbor was bombed.
Perfect example of that is Marco Rubio in the debate with Trump. Marco Rubio is basically like the biggest warmonger. He advocates us like going to war with Iran and all these Muslim countries,
right,
as well as going to war with Russia. But then at the same time, he can be very politically correct and say we have to be sensitive to the feelings of Muslims and show that we're tolerant. So you get these people that are the biggest warmongers, but at the same time, they're very politically correct about not offending the sensibilities of Muslims at the same time.
I think they tried to get away. You can almost get away with anything if you do it in a culturally Marxist way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like this is positive bombing if it's for culturally Marxist reasons.
Yeah. I don't think, by the way, neoconservatives or people like Rubio are full-fledged cultural Marxists. I think they share some of the assumptions of the cultural Marxists. The multiculturalism, open borders, this kind of stuff. I think they have a much more realistic understanding of what the Muslims are doing. And in the case of the neocons, is because they're Jewish. And they see that they're enemies of Israel and that they target Jews in Europe and so forth. So I think there's ethnic considerations there. But when they're trying to get other people to rally to their side, it's the kind of argument that I read by this one lady, I think something like Jillian Melchior was her name. She writes for National Review that, by not supporting the Ukrainians, we are turning over the transgendered or something to Putin. And I looked at it, who the hell cares about this?
This is what's going on in Syria. Is you have Assad in Syria. He's a very he's probably the most moderate leader in the Middle East. He's protecting Christians. But the neocons hate him so much because he's traditionally been an enemy of Israel that they're willing to let basically like ISIS and al-Qaeda take over. I mean, they've been supporting the al-Nusra Front, which is basically al-Qaeda.
Right.
Another thing that's kind of interesting about Assad and even Ahmadinejad is that both of them have met with David Duke. So I feel that definitely sends a shiver down the neocons' spine.
No, there's
no associations
about
with those types. Yeah.
By the way, I've met David Duke. He is every bit as crazy as they say he is. But he also sees, I don't know, rabbinic Judaism controlling everything. It's like, you know, the leaders of the American government in the evening are like running to read the Talmud all the time or something. like unbelievable things. I would not, however, I think it was Ann Coulter who said she would not compare him to Al Sharpton, who's 100 times more evil. I would agree.
I mean, the thing about Duke is I see him, he's kooky, but I don't see him as a malicious or a bad person.
No, I don't either.
See him as kind
of... Yeah, no, I didn't mean to demonize him. I just think he's kooky. Sharpton is evil. He's an evil demagogue. He's horrible, Sharpton. And yet for years he was appearing on Fox News, and the Fox News people were fawning all over him. And, you know, he's a main advisor to, like, Hillary and these other people. I mean, he has done absolutely horrible things, like incite mobs against Jewish shopkeepers and this. But everything is forgiven because he's black and he's associated with the left. So you don't have to really, you know, you shouldn't get angry at him. But he's a thoroughly despicable person.
We are getting... towards the end of the show, we only have about 5 minutes left. Is there anything crucial about the book that I didn't get a chance to touch upon?
One of the arguments in the book that I'm sure that, you know, will be discussed somewhere and comes to us is, I think, probably the most provocative thing. I suspect, however, it will be largely missed. What I say is that there is no right that has really, well, the right has been almost entirely vestigial since the end of fascism. And the arguments that take place within our political discourse are almost entirely arguments of the left. We argue in terms of leftist ideals, human rights, universalism, open borders, you know, global democracy, whatever. I mean, these are all values of the left. And what becomes distinctions between right and left in our time, where conservative and liberal, are arbitrary. You know, you create litmus tests like, you know, who's for or against Israel, or who's for ecology. Ecology can be a right-wing issue, can be a left-wing issue. But depending on, you know, the needs of your political parties or who's supporting which side, something becomes conservative or liberal. And but there is no right. The right has been pretty much eliminated, and you know, as it just exists in spots in the Western world. Now, Eastern Europe, of course, is different. You do have right there, but I think that this might occasion some discussion at this point, because it is not one that is usually made. And I also suggest that this belief in liberal democracy is essentially a leftist belief, because it assumes universalism, something like human rights, ideas that really come out of the left wing of the French Revolution.
We are basically out of time, so I would like to thank Paul Gottfried for being on. Check out his book, Fascism, The Career of a Concept. So, and Alex, thanks for being on as well.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.